Afterburn Podcast is brought to you by BogeyDope.com. Flying for the Air National Guard or Air Force Reserves means enjoying the same perks as active duty pilots, but with far more freedom to choose what you fly, where you live, and how often you work. BogeyDope.com launches your aviation career with the Guard or Reserves through a suite of e-courses, coaching sessions, and free resources. Find out what units are hiring, how to rush units, application and interview prep, and much more. They've just announced BogeyDope Bootcamp, a three-month live course dedicated to getting you into the cockpit of your dreams. Visit BogeyDope.com, that's BogeyDope.com, or click the link down in the show notes, and you can use the code AFTERBURN for 5% off. Wingman Watch was founded by a group of pilots with one goal in mind: build a high-quality timepiece inspired by vintage military aviation and at an affordable price. Let Wingman Watch build your watch today. Whether it be for your fighter squadron, your bomber squadron, your cargo unit, your army unit, your fire department, whatever it might be, let Wingman Watch take your inspiration and create something that will last forever. You can visit wingmanwatch.com and use the code RAIN10 to get something that is currently built, or mention my name and start your custom timepiece today. I also like to thank AOPA for allowing us to film this episode with Mace at their booth at Oshkosh. You'll notice this might sound a little bit different because we're sitting out there live with planes flying around, but it was fun to chat. And again, big thanks to AOPA. You can go over to AOPA.org and check them out. I'm a member and I have their membership plus pilot protection services, because again, you'll never know when you might need someone to help you out with your medical or just dig into some training and additional resources. You can visit AOPA.org.
Altitude.
Seat tight, Altimeter Zero Eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire projector. Close
me, my friend, today. Pilot, my friend, Rav Garibaldi,
354. Viper 01, be advised, the restricted area 6002 is still active.
Turn in, lights on.
My guest today is Michelle Mace Curran. She's a former Thunderbird F-16 fighter pilot who now has ventured out doing some pretty cool stuff. I had fun chatting with Mace, and I think you'll enjoy hearing her story as well. Again, thanks to all my Patreon supporters, and thank you to all those who swing over and take the time at iTunes and Spotify to drop a rating review, helping the podcast out. Feel free to check out the Afterburn Podcast on YouTube if you want to watch this episode, as well as any other ones. With that being said, let's jump into the podcast with Mace.
Awesome. We're here at Oshkosh 22. I'm excited to be here with Mace. We're going to chat a little bit about her career, maybe some Air Force stuff, maybe not, maybe some things that are going on in life. But Mace, thanks for joining the podcast. I'm happy to have you here. It's awesome to be able to actually connect finally in person.
For real. We've been Instagram friends for a long time, but meet in person at Oshkosh.
Living in the mom's basement. You know,
yeah, exactly. Back and trolling forth. Each other.
So what have you thought about Oshkosh so far?
So I've been to a lot of air shows, right?
Yep.
And I grew up 2 hours from here, so you'd think this would not be my first time at Oshkosh, but it is, in fact.
Really?
It's a little overwhelming. When I first walked in the gate, I had no idea where I was going, and I was very surprised by how much stuff is here. Now that I have my bearings a little bit, it's pretty awesome.
I'm curious to see the numbers. I know, like, last year, I think they had, like, 640,000 people, but you can't, like, in a week, you still can't go through everything that's here. I mean, it's everything and anything. Like, it's crazy.
I've probably seen 5% of what's here.
That's wild. So you grew up 2 hours from here. Did you want to get into aviation as a young girl, or like,
So I grew up in a small town, 4,000 people, Medford, Wisconsin. Not a military family, not an aviation family. So I just really had no exposure to it.
Yeah.
In high school, there was one kid in my school, a year younger than me, who started taking lessons in a Cessna.
Yeah.
And I remember asking him about it all the time, and asking my parents for flying lessons, and they were like, yeah, we can't afford those. And it just kind of, that was the end of the conversation. And then I stopped thinking about it for a while until it was time to figure out how to pay for college.
Right.
And my dad suggested ROTC, and I was like, no, I want to be a normal college kid. I want to live in the dorms and go to parties, because you don't really know what to expect. That's what you think college is.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then we looked into it, and I was like, okay, I don't want to stay in my small town in Wisconsin, and this would give me a lot of opportunities to travel. So I decided to apply for a scholarship and got one, went off to the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, but as a criminal justice major, planning on doing OSI.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. That's funny you even, like, knew all about that. So I was probably very similar, but I grew up in a community that was surrounded by like Delta pilots. Okay. Who were all ex-Air Force or Navy. My parents weren't, like, kind of similar story there, but my dad kind of pushed me that direction. But then I went to Georgia Tech, I did international affairs, so I was like the standalone. Like, if I got hit in the eye with a rock, I had no plan B. So I'm like, I'm glad it worked out. But how did you even like figure out, like, I didn't know what OSI was probably until I was in the Air Force. Like, that's something very specific coming from someone who's not surrounded by people like that. How did you even like figure that out? And
so I wanted to be an FBI agent.
Okay.
All that right. was the end game.
Yeah.
I think I really liked the X-Files, which is the most accurate FBI show on TV.
I don't think it's, I mean, I think that's what they do every single day. Yeah. It's busy. It's busy.
Right. Exciting. So I wanted to be an FBI agent, and a criminal justice major made sense for that. And so I think when I went and applied for my ROTC scholarship, I kind of asked about the best job options that would set me up for that, because I was going to get college paid for, going to active duty for 4 years yep. to pay that time back as an OSI agent, and also check the box of military time to go to a federal agency, because they like that on an right. application. And then I was going to leave and go to the FBI. Clearly that happened.
Yeah, you took a slight detour. I don't know where that fork in the road occurred, but obviously it was probably somewhere a few years back. What was that fork in the road? Like, how did you, like, all right, hey, now I want to be a pilot?
Yeah, so it was a very distinct moment. There were, throughout ROTC, people would always ask, like, who here wants to be a pilot? And people would raise their hands. Like, every instructor would ask that, and I didn't raise my hand. But I was a little bit intrigued by it.
Yeah.
But I just didn't know that much about it. And then we went to Tyndall on a base visit. I think about halfway through college, and I saw my first fighter aircraft take off, because I just had no exposure to it before that. Sadly, it was not F-16s, it was two F-15s.
Yeah, it is what it is.
Full
right?
AB.
Yeah.
It was dusk, they were taking off for a night sortie, and it was just like jaw drop, goosebumps, holy crap, forget the FBI.
Yeah.
I'm already in a position, I'm already an ROTC cadet on scholarship, so all I have to do is start raising my hand. And so that was the pivotal moment.
That's really cool. And still, there's a lot that goes on between saying, hey, I want to do that, and actually getting selected and going to pilot training. And then it turns out there's a few steps in there. How was, like, overall, like, your experience, like, going through pilot training and, yeah, any, like, big hurdles or, like, takeaways from that experience?
So I got a pilot slot. That part wasn't too bad because I had a decent GPA, decent at physical fitness. And then I got to IFS. Initial flight screening out of Pueblo in the DA-20.
Super nice place.
Super nice place. It's like prison, but
I think it's actually run by a prison company.
Like, it could be. Yeah. It has those vibes. I went into that. You know, you get all the way through solo, and I had zero flight time, no GA background, and a lot of my peers had their private pilot's license, or they just had the exposure, or they had mechanical backgrounds. They grew up working on cars, or they were engineering majors. Right. Criminal justice, not super helpful. So that program was a little bit of a shock, because the first few weeks, I just didn't understand any of the things that were being thrown at me. I didn't understand aerodynamics and just like things like the oil system and hydraulics. All of that was new. So there was like one moment, I remember it was like midnight. I had to be up at 5 a.m. the next morning. I'm in my little prison cell,
right,
just cramming through all this information that I don't even understand, and I had this realization that I might not be good enough to like do the program, which had never happened in my life before.
Yeah.
But it was very short-lived, because that program's only about a month long. So I ended up getting there, and when I left, I remember the day I checked out and I went to see my flight commander to get signed off to leave, and he's like, you did such a good job. And I was like, what? The entire time I thought I was about to wash out of this program. So that one was probably the most aggressive steep learning curve, just from where I was starting.
Yeah.
Then pilot training itself, I really had a great time, honestly. Yeah. It was super fun, exciting. My class was amazing. Stressful, of course.
Right.
But you're in that stressful situation with like 20 of your best friends, and you're all going through those same hurdles together. So I enjoyed it. Was able to track T-38s, and then there definitely was some stress leading up to drop night.
Yeah, no joke.
As you know. I don't know about your class, but my class got two fighter aircraft for 25 people, which is pretty standard at the time, I think.
Yeah, so like when I went through, we had two of us go from T-6s. We washed back to build a big enough T-38 class. And then we had, you know, the standard, get the dream sheet a couple weeks before assignment night. And I want to say it was like 3 or 4 days before Simon and I, the squadron commander, walked in and said, hey guys, here's a new dream sheet. It has every aircraft in the Air Force, because you guys are going to get heavies in your drop, which was like the first time that it ever happened at Columbus. I think it had happened at like Vance first. And he's like, I don't know what it's going to look like. He's like, just fill out like your top 30 choices and we'll figure it out. And so like, that was like soul crushing. Like, because again, you're expecting everyone to go to a fighter bomber or FAPE, such as myself. And so you just didn't know how to handle it. I want to jump back real quick to IFS.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're talking about the struggles going through that, like basically like the self-doubt, which I think everyone does, because you're getting crushed. And in the flying world, you don't know it at that time. Like, if you do a good job, no one's going to tell you. It's like, if they don't say anything about it, like, you can count that as a win. Like, yeah, you did it right. But you don't know that so young. I would say our IFS class, I don't know if it's still this way, but I imagine it's got to be close. I think we started with 70, and the attrition rate was somewhere around like 30%, which is like the highest attrition rate of any of the Air Force programs. So we saw people leaving,
for sure,
going through, which was really stressful. But the way I did it, I was just like, keep trucking forward and like put your head down and go. It's like, it sounds like you kind of a similar path, like kind of get through that.
Yeah, I think that's what I've always done, is like, quitting is never an option. You're just going to keep trucking forward. But that doesn't mean you're not struggling with being like, holy crap, what am I getting myself into?
Yeah.
So
it's a
tricky program.
It's an interesting world going into the flying piece. And then when you jump into the, like, the fighter side of the house, there's, wasn't super easy for me. There's definitely a lot of like debriefs that were relatively painful. But it's just kind of those things that I just, you know, put the head down, try to like learn from that and like make myself better for the next round. But you jumped right to the Viper out of pilot training.
Yeah.
How was that?
That was also quite the leap, for sure.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Which, funny that you were, I didn't even know you were a FAPE.
Yeah.
But on my drop night, I was convinced I was going to become a T6 FAPE. That's what was going to happen. And all of my IPs knew that, so they messed with me. So of 25 people in the class, I got to find out last.
That's awesome.
And they did like this Google Earth thing where we're at Columbus and someone made this fancy program where it would like zoom out, circle around, and then it would zoom into the base you were going to. And so mine, it zooms out from Columbus, circles around, starts to zoom back into Columbus, and then it hops over to Luke in Phoenix,
which is
F-16 training. And I was up there just like holding my mug of beer, about to lose it. So that was funny. But I went off to Luke for F-16s, and the flying of the jet wasn't that hard of an adjustment.
Yeah.
It was the tactics that we started to learn, and that was a lot. And again, I'm like, man, I should have been an engineering major or something that would have prepared me a little bit better for this. But criminal justice does not set you up to understand frequencies and like fuse delays and all that stuff. I was just like, what is happening?
Not coming from an engineering background, I'm not very smart.
Same.
So like, there are like people who are like very smart flying these fast planes, and they just like get it. I had to work, I think, pretty hard to like figure this stuff out. And there's so much to know. Like, that's like management. So big picture too, like, this kind of ties into a little bit what you're doing now, because you've taken a slightly different career path outside the Air Force, and we're going to get to that. But managing these like big problems or very detailed oriented problems that are challenging, how do you kind of go through, how do you manage that? Grenade.
Yeah, it's so easy to get overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And then as you start to get overwhelmed, you get that like snowball effect and like hopeless feeling. The same thing that can happen on a flight, you know, a check ride, one little thing goes wrong and then you're stressed about that and it just piles up. So I was not that good at managing it at first, honestly.
Yeah.
I flailed around a lot, and if I knew some of the stuff I knew now and went back and did it again, I would have definitely asked for more help.
Yeah.
Because I felt like I needed to prove something, I think.
Absolutely.
And especially almost always being the only woman in the group, that made that pressure a little bit greater, under a microscope. So I felt like I had to be the one that knew all the things, and I couldn't ask for help. And so knowing now that, actually having the humility to be like, hey, can you spend some extra time explaining that to me? People actually look at that as a strength, not a weakness.
100%.
But my perspective on that was skewed at that point.
Mine was too, And I think that's really, I didn't really think about that, but like asking for help. So when I was going through Pitt, we had a C model guy going through Pitt, and you know, he was the only fighter guy. You know, in my mind, this guy was up on a pedestal, knew everything, super smart. He's got a PhD now. Like, he's that type of guy. But he was not afraid to like ask questions in class. Like, I would sit there, shut up. If I didn't know something, like maybe I'd ask a bro like later on, or I would try, you know, it was gonna be in private. But without fail, he might ask like 15 questions and it'd be like the simple question. It was the exact thing I was wondering about, had no fear doing it. And to me, I took away, and that's something I carry today, is like, I think it is a strength. Like, one, there's a little humility in there that you don't know everything, and it doesn't matter what job you're in, but being willing to ask questions and lean on people who have more experience than you, that maybe they work for you, maybe you work for them. Like, that's a tough thing for people to overcome, I think.
Yeah, because I saw it as showing weakness, and like that was going to be looked upon as a fault. And a lot of it was me not understanding fighter pilot culture.
Yeah.
And being new to what, you know, coming in without a lot of perspective, I felt like was all like super type A, like very, very confident. And I was a super shy kid. I'm an introvert. Like, I'm just not, I don't usually speak up in like group settings. And so I was trying to fit into this new culture that I just didn't get yet. And all of that led to me not asking for help when I should have. And so I just struggled along behind the scenes, and it worked out, obviously, but it was painful.
Yeah, there's definitely, but those moments I think make you stronger, right? Like, now that's a, that is something that you care with, like how you execute on a daily basis. But I always say, like, there are those that have and those that will. Like, I think it applies to everything. So you might, maybe you understand concept A and I don't, but I understand B and you don't. Yeah. Like, not being afraid to like ask questions and lean on people, because I think we make each other stronger. That is not an easy thing just to overcome. You hit on this, which for those watching and listening, this is probably an obvious thing, but you're female. Female fighter pilots are, I would say, not rare, but the percentage-wise is relatively low, obviously, compared to males. Yep. What were some of the challenges you faced, like probably just being typically the only woman in a group of 15 or whatever it might be? Like, it had to present a few challenges, I imagine.
Yeah, so I think the number is somewhere around 3% of Air Force fighter pilots are women.
Yeah, it's relatively low.
Yeah, I think we all know each other because it's so low, which is cool, because it's almost like this super close-knit group that automatically forms, and there's always people you can reach out to for stuff. But you will usually find yourself as the only one or maybe one of two in a squadron. Yeah. And it became less of a challenge as I got older and more confident and more comfortable in my skills as a pilot and in just the dynamics in the squadron. But when I was brand new, I know that IFF, you know, the first exposure to fighter culture kind of, which I think, at least the program I went through, the instructors weren't just exposing you to tactics for the first time. They also wanted to give you the shock of what fighter pilot culture should be.
Right.
And I was coming through in 2011, so it was a really pivotal point for culture in the fighter squadrons.
Yeah, big.
Yeah, you were moving away from kind of what you imagined from Vietnam, where it was a little more rough around the edges, to more what you see now. And so there was some resistance to that shift.
Maybe a little bit.
Yes.
If I remember correctly. Yeah.
So being a woman in a squadron when that was happening, I think there were some people that were frustrated with it. And that's a whole, you can do a whole episode on just that.
Yep.
But IFF specifically, my flight commander, we did our first roll call. My flight commander pulls me aside beforehand and gives me like this pre-brief on all these things that are going to happen. And some of the stuff he said was completely insane to me now. He's like, there could be pornography on the screens. There could be this happening. This is what we're going to do, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, if that makes you uncomfortable, you can leave.
But was it, so you specifically like pulled aside?
And all by myself in the dude's flight commander's office. That moment sticks out to me. It was like burned into my memory because I was like, this is what I just stepped into, because I didn't really know what to expect.
Right.
And honestly, the stuff he talked about ended up not happening or not being a big deal. But I remember being so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I'm a brand new lieutenant and this is a major. And I'm just like, what am I getting myself into? So that sticks with me. Once I got off to my first combat squadron in Misawa. I had Smoke and Sharon was another woman, and she was also in my B course class, so we knew each other and were good friends, and that was just so amazing to have another person. But it was stuff that seems insignificant, like not having flight suits with extended zippers so you can use a pedal pack in the jet.
Or still, Josh.
We can do an episode on that as well. It's quite the process. Or just not having flight gear that fits you, or going somewhere and there's only a male bathroom.
Yeah.
And they just, like, don't have a women's bathroom because there are no women in that squadron, even though there are.
Right.
Just little stuff like that seems insignificant, but it just grinds on you over time.
Yeah.
And then another thing I always noticed, and this happened my entire career, is being either on a group email or in a briefing or, like, in an assembly of the whole squadron. So there's 50 of us in there, and whoever's on the stage being like, all right, gents, or all right, gentlemen, dudes, men. And, like, they don't mean anything bad by it, but every time I was very aware that I was different from everyone else.
Yeah.
And sometimes they would be aware that they did that after they said it, so then they'd be like, and Mace.
And Mace, yeah.
And so then I'm like, okay, I don't know if I'd rather just have you group me with everyone else or call me out. I'd probably just have rather be called a gent or a dude.
Yeah.
But, again, insignificant by itself, but when, you know, 10 years of that all the time, you're like, I'm not like everyone else.
Yeah.
So,
which I think, one, we can talk more about this, too, because I think it is interesting. The one thing I found out in, you know, the squadron, so diversity-wise, maybe not, you know, race, sex, like, those squadrons are not very diverse.
Yeah.
But from background-wise, I did find that they're, like, very unique individuals. So, like, they're not from Georgia like me. They're from, you know, some small town in New Mexico, and they grew up in a camper, and, like, you know, they don't wear shoes. They just walk barefoot around, like, very different than me.
Yeah.
But, like, there are those, like, that kind of diversity of thought and people, like, again, it's not the most diverse organization, right? So asterisk there. But I did find that I have some friends who, like, if we'd met outside of the military, like, we probably would not have hung out because we just come from such polar opposite places.
For sure.
But, yeah, it is interesting. The piddle pack thing. This thing, when I was deployed, this is too much sharing, right? But, like, you would burn through, like, 4 or 5 piddle packs in, like, an 8-hour sortie.
Yep.
Like, that's normal. Like, you're hydrated. So Tally Hallworth, a good friend of mine, she, only female fighter pilot in our squadron were deployed. Like, she would have to dehydrate herself. So you're doing a 7-hour sortie, but you're getting in the jet an hour early, and you're probably sitting in the jet for 45 minutes after you land.
Yep.
So it's a really long time span. And just from a physiological standpoint, not a good thing to dehydrate yourself, period. Definitely not a good thing to dehydrate yourself flying an F-16.
Nope.
But that was her tactic, because there was, like, no other good alternative getting around that. And that's, like, impeding your ability to go out there and perform.
Yeah.
So it sounds like the Air Force is trying to work around that. It's a problem.
They are. And there was a lot of frustrations when the extended zipper flight suits came on the market. Like, they are now made. They're produced just like the male versions are. But they're super difficult to get. And so when I was about to deploy to Afghanistan, I went to my AFE shop, so life support that has all our equipment, and I was like, I have to have extended zipper flight suits. I need to be able to go to the bathroom on these, like, 6-plus-hour flights. And they were, like, a couple weeks went by, and they're like, ma'am, we went to supply, we called all over the Air Force, and we were told there's not enough demand, so they don't carry them. I was like, I don't care if there's two of us. Like, you realize how much money you've spent to train us, and what you're asking us to do, you can't make a flight suit with a zipper this much longer.
Right.
So I was not happy. There's been a huge push to fix that, and I think it's getting better. But my guys in that shop got male flight suits in the right size, went into town, found a seamstress that would sew extended zippers in, and they gave me, like, 6 of them.
That's huge.
Yeah, so they were amazing. But I was very frustrated with the process at that point. I'm like, you're sending me to combat, and I can't get a zipper that's long enough? Like, how dumb is this? But yeah, the dehydration thing, I know a lot of people did that. I cannot imagine flying a combat sortie or even a long cross country without drinking enough water where I'd have to go to the bathroom.
I think, like, my standard, like, combat loadout, like, going to the jet was probably, like, I had a big thermos, like, where I'd, like, get cold water in, and then I would carry probably 4 bottles of water and then a bunch of snacks and stuff like that. Like, I have to have that.
Same.
Like to sustain. Otherwise, I just. Worst night of my life in combat was when my flight lead broke when we were in Iraq, and he air spared out, so he went back home. I stayed in Iraq, but I burned through all my snacks in like the first 45 minutes, and I was like, "This is a terrible night. This is gonna be a really long night after this point." So it's those simple things, but you know, it is amazing that the amount of money we spend on certain things. Like again, if there's 30 female fighter pilots, obviously the demand is not going to be huge compared to regular flight suits, but we spend a lot of money on
a lot of things. Yeah,
so,
yeah, for sure. So there's been so many initiatives over the last few years though to fix that, with everything from combat vests and G suits to flight suits and different options of how to go to the bathroom, and the Air Force is really working hard to fix that, so it's good to see. But it was a lot of trial and error of piddle packs.
Yeah.
And this is a funny story. So when I was on the team, I showed up, I got fit for my first very tight blue suit.
Those things are tight.
Very, very, very tight. And I got it, and of course it needed adjusting, but it had a normal zipper in it. And I was like, this is not gonna work. And so we talked to the people that made it, they put an extended zipper in, and then they made that the standard for all women on the team, even support officers, because they'll fly in the back seat sometimes.
Yeah.
So that got fixed. But that suit is just not, there's not a lot of room for moving things around because it's so fitted. And so I got very good at going to the bathroom just a regular piddle pack on cross countries, because cross country twice a week, every week. But it was not, I was 100% successful. And I know guys have experienced this too, because we've shared war stories.
Yeah.
And we talked about it on the radio on cross countries. Yeah. It was just funny. It was entertaining. Where you're like going to the bathroom and you can't see what's going on.
Yeah.
And then you're like all done and you hold up your piddle pack and you're like, that amount does not equal how long I just went to the bathroom.
Yeah, it's just not compute.
Yeah, and so you'll dry out eventually, but I'm like sitting in this, you know, $30 million airplane. I'm 30 something years old and I'm the lead solo for the Thunderbirds, and I'm like, I have pee pants.
Yeah.
And then you land and I get out of the airplane and I have to do an on-camera interview. And so now I'm on like local news channel, which could be for like New York City or something. A lot of people are going to see it. And I'm just like talking about the air show. In the back of my head, I'm like, I have pee pants.
People don't realize, you know, it's like the simple stuff. And you're like, ah, I think it's like, oh, and it's a fighter pilot, like all locked in. It's like, still have to go to the bathroom. And, you know, when you're in a 30 degree reclined seat.
Yes.
I never wore the blue flight suit. That thing looks, again, super tight.
Yes.
But there's not a lot of room in that F-16 to begin with.
Nope.
Like, just manage it. Yeah, there's some horror stories out there that, you know.
Probably
not for the podcast, but...
You could do a whole comedy episode on just bathroom mishaps in the jet.
I've heard, like, just, some, like, heinous ones from, like, generals and things like that from them back in the days. And you're like, hasn't changed much.
No, it's funny how comfortable you get with it, though, with among each other, because at first it's, like, so embarrassing.
Yeah.
But then you're like, well, this is just life. Like, this is just normal human function, and this is what we do for a living. I imagine it's kind of like that with, like, astronauts and stuff in space and all the weird stuff. Like, well, here we are.
Yeah, you're close. Your transition, so you're Misawa, right?
Yeah.
How is Misawa? Like, I fly over that now, and it looks really cold from 35,000 feet.
Yeah, so Misawa is an interesting assignment for me. It's beautiful. Northern Japan is gorgeous. The mission is really cool. Seed Squadron. That was my first combat squadron, and I... Definitely the stuff we talked about earlier of like feeling like I had to prove myself and fit into this culture, and that really took hold of me there, and I struggled through that assignment. Not that I wasn't doing fine flying,
right?
But like in my own mind, I was in over my head and I didn't belong there.
I think, I mean, for those listening too, like you don't want to go against the grain in a fighter squadron. Like if you're one nail sticking with the wrong direction, like you're gonna get swacked. So that is a big part of the culture, because you're a team, you know, working towards the same objective. Like that's the push. And if you're gonna be the one who's going against the grain, like I imagine. So yeah, I think that's important to highlight
for
those who don't quite understand the culture. It's not like you just do your own thing and it's gonna work out well for you. Like it might, but probably not, right?
And I always like, it's kind of weird to talk about, because I had such great friends in that squadron, in that assignment, and we were really good at what we did. That was such a high-performing squadron that I was part of. But just me being where I was in my career, first lieutenant, brand new to the jet, just the seed mission, even piloting on more technical stuff, I was just like, I feel like I'm going through med school right now. This is just so much stuff. And then again, being, you know, one of two women in that squadron, and you show up, you're not in you don't have a call sign yet. There is, I think, pressure to prove yourself.
Yeah, 100%.
In the community, and I felt like I had to establish this reputation.
Yeah.
In this community I was going to be a part of for a long time. And because I knew that it would follow you from base to base, and I was going to get named and all of this stuff. And so I struggled with that a little bit, feeling like I had to pretend to be this person I wasn't. And that got better with time and experience and maturity. But I struggled at Misawa. And again, I think I did fine flying. I became a flight lead, and there were no big issues.
Way to the Thunderbirds.
I eventually got to the
Thunderbirds. You probably did okay.
But man, in my head, I was like, how am I going to do this for 10 years? Because you have a 10-year commitment. I'm like, you know, maybe a year into it at that point, or 2 years into it.
Did you just kind of bear down and just like, yeah, yep, just suck it up? And
I did. But on it, looking back at it now, I think I also went through a divorce while I was there.
Okay.
So the combination of all of that, I think I should have reached out for help to someone. Like, we talk about mental health stuff.
Yeah.
I think I should have reached out to like a professional or my flight commander or someone. And I had friends that were supportive, but the ops tempo is so busy there, and they have their own lives going on. And so you're kind of just by yourself a lot. And Misawa, everyone lives on base, or most people live on base. I lived in a quadplex building. Everyone in that building were other pilots in my squadron. So just going through something so like personal in your life, you're in a fishbowl.
Yeah.
And so you feel like everyone knows what's going on. Everyone's watching it happen. The squadron commander I had at the time was not very good with emotional intelligence and handling it. He's a super smart guy.
Yeah.
Patch, great pilot, but he was like, oh boy, I don't like,
yeah,
just fix your shit so you can be a functioning member of the squadron. That was about the support I got. So it was a lot.
And I can see, like, especially being, you know, new to the squadron, and then you're obviously dealing with a lot of life stuff, but then like being that close to work and something that's very difficult personally, you're trying not to like let that bleed over, but then everyone like kind of knows is like, well, yeah, she's,
yeah,
got all this going on. I can't imagine having to deal with all that.
For sure. And people didn't really know what to do. They'd be like, sorry. And they're like, so you're ready to brief?
Right. Yeah. I wouldn't, I mean, honestly, I wouldn't, yeah, know, like facing that, because you're like, you know,
you don't want to cry.
But what do you say? And like, what do you do? And you know, it's not good, but yeah, that'd be a tough situation to go through.
Yeah. So again, that squadron was so good at the mission, and it's such a beautiful place to live, and there's a lot of cool cultural stuff there, and so many people love that assignment. Personally, I struggled through it, but that 3 years also taught me more than like any time in my career field, or like in my career.
Yeah, in what way?
Just, I had never, so I, you know, had those little moments of doubt and struggling with IFS and just going to IFF and the culture and stuff, but none of it felt like something I couldn't overcome.
Yeah.
But Misawa, that stuff all just piled up at once, and I was just slogging through. Like, I didn't have another choice.
Right.
So I would drive to work and sit in my car and not want to go in the squadron. And then I would go home and I would just go to bed at like 7 p.m. because, like, you're just existing. So it was not fun. And the catalyst to fix that was really PCSing to my next assignment.
Okay.
And then also sometimes, like, separation from all this stuff in my personal life. But my last 8-9 months in Misawa, I also got picked up as a safety observer for PACAF demo.
Okay.
And that got me out of Misawa. I got to go TDY with Code Brown. I don't know if you know him, but great dude. That whole demo team, the maintenance and everything, is just tight knit, really good people. I got to go to Malaysia, different places in Japan. And
that's cool.
That was like a breath of fresh air, just something new outside of that environment.
Yeah, pulling yourself away and separating yourself. And then again, I think that translates to a lot of things in life. Sure. You know, when you're down in the weeds and in the trenches, like, you can't have that 30,000 foot view of like the bigger picture, and getting that like bigger picture, I think, helps again in a lot of different ways depending on what you're dealing with. So
you cannot read the label from the inside of the jar.
Yeah, there you go. I love, almost steal that one.
Yeah, you're just stuck in there.
Yeah, 100%. So yeah.
But PCSing to my next assignment, which was a TFI, so blended with a reserve squadron at Fort Worth, that was an incredible assignment. And I grew as a person over those 3 years, like night and day.
I think we actually met there when I did the Alliance show.
Oh, yeah.
We went to dinner.
Dinner.
Yeah, yeah, so.
Yeah, I do remember
that. We lied in the opening.
Sorry.
So, yeah, there we go. The random thought.
What's it called? The Stockyards.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that.
That's a good, so the TFI gig, again, you know, active duty mixed with guard, like, to me, that looked like an amazing deal. I knew as, like, a senior captain, 04, like, if I hadn't done demo, like, low PK that they would send me there, because a lot of people go there and, like, it's a very easy transition out of active duty into the Guard or Reserve. But can you talk, like, kind of how that assignment was?
Yeah, so coming off of my time at Misawa and just all the things that had happened there, finding out I was going to a TFI squadron, because the ops tempo was so high at Misawa, 12 to 15-hour days, I was just the epitome of burned out, like, as burned out as you can get. The day my squadron commander came in and was like, I found out your assignment, and he's like, I'm really excited for you. He's like, you're going TFI to Fort Worth. It was like someone just threw me a lifeline.
Jackpot, yeah.
I was like, okay, this is a reset. I can get back on top of all this stuff. And it was intimidating going there for a couple of reasons. Very experienced squadron.
Yeah.
There's a ton of patches in that squadron, something like 12 of them.
It's like all.
They're all weapons school graduates. They had never had a woman fly in the squadron in the entire history. Never, not one.
Texas.
Yeah, well, and reserves, they pick and choose who they hire. Not that they wouldn't hire a woman, but they choose people more than even flying skill. They choose personalities because people in the reserves or the guard stay there for a long time. So they're building their family, their tribe.
Yeah. And again, like I said, a lot of weapons officers, Clancy Moracle, now I forget her last name, she's married, but like she was one of my students going through. Yep. She was the first female to go through F-16 weapons school in the history of F-16 weapons school, which is like 2015 or 2014 she went through.
Not
like
that long ago.
Yeah, so there's not, there's not many female patches roaming around the Viper.
It's true.
Let alone female fighter pilots. So yeah, the pool's small.
Yeah, so I was a little worried as I was showing up there because I knew they hadn't by choice hired any women to fly for them. And now since they have this small contingent of active duty, there are 6 to 8 of us at any given point, 6 to 9 of us at any given point.
Yeah, there you go.
I was being kind of forced upon them. So I was like, ooh, how's this going to go? They were amazing. So, so humble, and they could have been super arrogant just based on their experience level and their skill set, but they didn't have anything to prove.
Right.
And because they had kind of like picked this group of people, there were no black sheep in the squadron. There were no assholes in the squadron.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was zero people where I would see my name on the schedule with them and be like, oh, no.
That's huge.
And there's almost always a few of those in every squadron.
And if you don't know, like, you're that person, right? Like, there's always that guy, you know? So you're like, and then you're like, wait, maybe it's me.
Maybe it was me. Yeah.
That's all. Like, but again, like, the guards and the reserves are different because they when they hire someone, they're doing it because for the next 20 years, this person is going to be in the unit. And if you hire a dud, like, you're owning it and paying for it for decades, potentially. So they do a very good job of screening. There's some units that have had some bad apples. And again, it's taken generations to kind of get out. So, yeah.
And one bad personality can change the entire squadron.
100%.
It's incredible.
The reason I got out was really because of one commander, and it wasn't just me. I think you probably can attribute 4 or 5 patches getting out of the Air Force because of him, and you probably can attribute another like 12. And it's like it literally one bad person. And the reason is he's gonna keep moving on. You're gonna keep moving up. The problems are only gonna get bigger and more complex. And maybe you get along with the bad apple, but like ultimately like. He has say over where I go, and really for me, it's like, I can deal with a lot of stuff, but as you drag your family to potentially a really bad deal because something didn't go well at work and you're being punished, like the ramifications are very different. So it is, one bad person can be so, it's a cancer.
Yep.
You gotta cut the cancer out and get rid of them.
It's hard to do.
The Air Force is struggling, and obviously there are phenomenal people in the Air Force, but this is a conversation that comes up quite routinely. Like, unfortunately, I was talking to a wing commander last night. I think like the best thing the Air Force did was get rid of like the below the zone and like school selects to like major, because not to go too far down the road, you would pick your show pony, as I call them, very young.
Yep.
And just because you're great at flying the jet tactically doesn't mean you're necessarily a great leader.
For sure.
There are obviously guys and gals that do both very well, but sometimes you pick the guy who does very well tactically and just moves up the food chain, and it's like, that is not the person that you need to be in command. And unfortunately, they can do a lot of damage on the way, the you know, the gorilla in the china shop just smashing and breaking things and leaving a wake of destruction.
For sure. Yeah, it's a retention problem.
Yeah, 100%.
Sure. Pushes people out.
So that kind of jumps into the retention piece. Thunderbirds.
Yeah.
Doing a lot of air shows, flyovers, go out there, engage in the community, hopefully like recruit, you know, inspiring the next generation to fly. How was your experience on the team?
So the Thunderbirds is such a unique assignment, and you probably experienced some in Viper demo. The coolest parts of my career and the best people I worked with, and also some of the hardest parts of my career.
Really?
The schedule is very difficult, and you're in a little bit of a pressure cooker. So on average, the team's gone about 240 days a year.
That's a lot.
For 3 years.
Yeah.
Yep. So that is hard. That's the hardest part, is you're gone from your family. Every weekend is an air show, which you could be at the coolest air show ever, but you miss a lot of things. When you're gone Thursday to Monday from March to November, you're going to miss kids' baseball games. You're going to miss graduations and weddings and just all kinds of things. Fourth of July weekends, like everything. So I realize it's hard to complain about that because people see the shiny side.
Absolutely.
And they're like, well, you're doing the coolest job on the planet. Wow, how can you complain? But you're still human. You still have families. Like, I met my husband when I first moved to Vegas. And so we got married just a couple of months into my first show season. And so our whole first 3 years of marriage, I was gone 240 days a year. So that's hard, no matter how fun the job is. So you have that side. And then the fatigue of constantly hopping time zones every week, going cross country twice a week. But then you have just, the flying was by far the most fun flying I did.
Yeah,
absolutely. Sure. Like flying upside down over the Pacific Ocean at 100 feet. And like when I got proficient, I would be more aware of what else was going on besides just staring at my HUD.
Yeah.
And I would see like a boat over there and I'd be like, oh, look, pelicans. And I'd be like, there goes the show center boat. And it's just such a surreal setting. I remember the first couple shows going from learning this routine and practicing over the desert, over the range, which is just brown dirt. Yep. And so there's not a lot of things to distract you, to rolling in and taking the line, and there's like cows and cars and power lines. Yeah. And I'm just like, holy crap, there's so much going on. But as you get more comfortable in it, again, you realize how cool it is.
100%.
The stuff that you're doing. And then the formation stuff, I, like a lot of fighter pilots who have not done it, probably underestimated the difficulty.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, loops to music. How hard could it be? Flying the loop and the roll when you're not on the source and you're the outrigger is the hardest stuff I did in the whole demo.
I believe it.
Yeah, the roll.
So you always joke, like, coming up initial or whatever, like, you know, number four is on the end of the whip there. Oh, yeah. But, like, you're doing loops and rolling. Like, you're really on the end of the whip, especially as, like, the solo, like, when you're hopping into the diamond, the whole six ship there. Like, how long was that upgrade process? Like, get, like, hey, certified by COMAC, you're ready to go. Getting proficient and comfortable is, like, a whole other story, but.
Yeah, so showed up in October, started really flying in November as the last team was wrapping up show season. And then COMAC cert was, I think, in, like, early March.
Okay.
So you have a handful of months there. I flew well over 100 upgrade sorties in that amount of time. Yeah, I was crushing my hour count for any other year.
Right.
We would fly, sometimes we would double turn every day, Monday through Friday. And especially, I worked on my stuff with the lead solo at the time and just doing repetitions of single ship maneuvers, 8 points, 4 points, inverted stuff, all that. And then the diamonds working on like all their diamond specific stuff. And then we come together as a Delta, you start to sequence the show together. You work on flying formation as a Delta, which you could do a whole flight of just working on that over and over because it takes so many repetitions. And then as you get to the point where you're like, okay, we can go through an entire show sequence. Now it's like full throttle because everyone is flying together. It's the same six pilots, every sortie. The schedule is mirrored just over and over all week long. And that gets exhausting.
Yeah. That's soul crushing hearing like that, just how busy that is.
We always said that our family is like training season because we were home at night. But for the pilots in the demo, training season was harder than show season because you're not getting the reward of getting all these cool opportunities and the feedback of the crowd and all of that. Right. It's just the grind.
Let's go fly, debrief in detail.
Again and again.
Go do it again and again. Yeah, that'd be soul crushing. But I mean, it's a pretty good deal. Again, yeah. It's like the shiny, like, to me, like doing demo was by far like the best assignment.
Yep.
I don't think, I was probably 220 days a year is like probably what my count was, but I had more autonomy. Like it was just like me and like 12 maintainers. So like we had a little bit more flexibility. Having such a big team, I'd imagine that presented some challenges as far as like, it's like everyone is doing this or yes. No one is doing this.
Yeah, there's a lot of, it's not like us, we as a team did not choose what we did, right? That's coming from Air Force level. That came from White House level at points for like flyover requests for 4th of July and that kind of thing. And it's like, okay, this is what we're doing. And the logistics of the demands on the team with everyone who wants to put them in specific spots, that trickles down to the operators in the actual cockpits and trying to move a team of, we would take about 70 people on the road.
Okay.
Trying to take 70 people in a C-17 across the country and getting tanker support and taking 8 F-16s. And it was just a big lift. We were extremely good at it because we did it all the time, but there would still be issues, maintenance issues, jets break places, C-17s fall out, tankers fall out, and so it was a lot. But I started off the 2019 season, so my first couple events ever for the public. First one, Super Bowl.
Giddy up.
Yep. Second one, Daytona 500.
Nice.
Third one, red carpet premiere of Captain Marvel in Hollywood. And then we got to go to the premiere and watch it with like the cast and the after party.
I do remember that too, because I remember Cajun's parents. I think you guys did a flyover of like their neighborhood stuff, which was really cool to see that happen. So.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, it was like off to the races, like ripping the Band-Aid off, like time to go do it.
I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. And everyone who had been on the team for a year was like, guys, like your expectations are now very skewed because there'll be months later where we're hitting small town after small town, middle of nowhere air show, like over and over and over. And there's none of the, like, they're just very standard air shows with no experiences like you just experienced. So, like, temper your expectations a little bit.
The bar just gets,
the bar was set very high.
Right out the gate. Well, I know you got a lot of other stuff going on, so I want to start kind of wrapping up. But I wanted, before we do that, kind of transition to, like, what are you doing now? Because you've, like, taken a slightly different path than most, leaving active duty. So can you kind of tell me a little bit, like, what you're doing now? And then also, like, where people can find you and things like that.
Yeah, for sure. So I'll give you a quick backstory. I was on my second year with the Thunderbirds, and I had kind of decided I was going to leave active duty just for family stability and that kind of thing. And I was looking at the airlines, as most of us do. And I was like, okay, that I could go fly for Southwest. We could be based in Vegas. Like, this all makes sense. And then the pandemic happened, and quite a few things happened. The airline industry was very uncertain for a while. And then we got asked to stay for a third year on the Thunderbirds. So my whole timeline of leaving active duty got pushed a year later. So actually, a blessing in disguise. It was a shock at the time because you're like kind of have this timeline in your head, and all of a sudden it's like whoop. But as everyone was experiencing in the middle of the pandemic, so I started exploring options outside of going to the airlines and kind of rethinking things. And I realized that I would not be super fulfilled doing that as much as it can create a great lifestyle for you. And I had been on social media, I'd been sharing these videos and kind of growing this following for, like, no monetization or anything, but just because it was fun to share with people. And so people were getting more aware of what I was doing. I got to be on the Kelly Clarkson show, which that's so strange, but really cool. It's like people would reach out and be like, hey, can you speak at this event? And I'm like, well, A, our schedule is soul-crushing. I don't have the time. And B, I can't do that stuff while I'm active duty. And so I kind of just filed that away. And I had a couple people that I met along the way that were in that industry that were like, hey, if you wanted to do public speaking, like, you have a great story, a great message, you could really inspire people. Okay. And when I thought about my time on the team, I really realized that I loved that part of the job.
Yeah.
Like, being able to have these interactions with a lot of, like, younger girls, like high school or early 20s, and just a few words, I could just see how big of an impact that made on them. And then everyone as well, men as well. And it was so fulfilling. That was like the coolest part of being a demo pilot. And so I started thinking about how I could continue to do that. And so definitely took the path less traveled. I left active duty. I'm still a reservist doing Air Force recruiting, which is kind of a natural transition. I'm going to go do that here in a few minutes.
Yep.
But then I started Upside Down Dreams, which is my own company doing like keynote speaking, some leadership consulting stuff, I'm working on a book, which is a whole about outside my comfort zone. Yeah. I'm like, what is going on? So I go around and share a lot of the stuff we talked about today, just feeling like an imposter, like I was in over my head, all that self-doubt that I struggled with. It's just such a contrast to share those very vulnerable stories. And then they see these videos of me as the lead solo.
Yeah.
And they're like, how is this the same person? And I really just want to show people that the things that they're struggling with, everyone struggles with.
Yeah.
And that I'm not on a pedestal with a halo. And that once you give them a peek behind the curtain, it all of a sudden, people have some perspective on their struggles. And it makes them realize what they can actually go do. And it's just so cool. Because I can see on their faces as I'm giving my speeches the impact that it's having. And it's so rewarding.
It's very cool to hear, right? Like, I mean, you put your pants on the same way like everyone else, you know? Like, it's everyone struggles, everyone goes through challenging times, but again, when you see what you've accomplished and then realize like, oh, like human being with the same type struggles. And for me, like that kind of stuff helps relate, like hearing those type stories, because we all go through that. So it's really cool you're out there sharing that. All right, we'll wrap up with this. I always ask someone, all right, if you found 15, 16, 17-year-old Mace walking down the street, is there any advice you would give her, tell her to do something different, something along those lines?
So I don't know that I would tell her to do something different, but I would probably try to emphasize the stuff we just talked about. Like, hey, you're going to think that you're not good enough and you're going to hit rough patches, but everyone around you also is doing that. So don't be afraid to share with them and reach out to them, because when you are vulnerable with people with that kind of stuff, it creates like these amazing deep relationships with them, and all of a sudden you have this support network that you would have never gotten if you keep it to yourself.
Awesome. Mace, I really appreciate it. Thanks for coming on the podcast. This is
for
fun.
Sure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode with Mace. It was fun recording with her up at Oshkosh. Got a few more episodes that were recorded up there. They'll be released in the next few weeks. As always, thanks for my Patreon supporters for supporting the podcast. Thanks for all those who've dropped over to iTunes and Spotify, YouTube, left a comment, left a rating or review, hit the like button. All those things help the algorithm show this podcast to more people. You can swing over to the afterburnpodcast.com for some swag and links to Patreon. As always, thanks for supporting the podcast.